Good morning. Hello? So, last time, I believe we talked about context switches. That was our main topic of one of our big topics of discussion that people got confused about. So, how we switch between processes. And on XP6, we talked about the strategy where we separated saving the user state from saving the state of the operating system kernel code that was responsible for servicing that particular program. So we had this kernel stack where we stored and churned out everything for the program. We first stored, whenever we had an exception, the information from the user stack. From the user registers onto the kernel stack. That was a kernel stack only for this particular program. And then later on, when we went and switched to another program, we would have this function which switched between kernel stacks. So we saved everything on the kernel stack and switched to a kernel stack for a different program. Each program has its own kernel stack that was allocated when the program was created. And then later on, to restore the user registers, we do the same thing we did to return from an exception. So in a system call, we didn't switch between programs. We have the picture where we have entering a trap handler and saving the registers and leaving a trap handler and restoring the registers, but for the same program. When we switch programs, we just happen to enter in one program and leave in the other. So, any questions about anything else we talked about in the last week before I move on to new and fantastic topics? Okay, so I'd like to make some notes about the homework. So it's due Friday. Hopefully you're aware of that and have maybe glanced at it. I know some people have finished it. Some people think the homework is hard or badly written. You're probably right, it's probably badly written. And I can make guesses as to what is confusing, but I don't know how likely I'd be to be right. And I have tried to make edits as I realize, oh, people are asking me like about locks. And well, you don't need to actually know about locks. You could copy the lock code and it would work, but you don't need to know about it. Like, it's not part of this assignment. But I'm trying to balance between like giving you complete requirements without like saying, hey, edit this line. And not having walls of text, because I know from experience that if I have like long descriptions of like how system calls work, no one's gonna read the whole assignment, including the parts which actually specify requirements. And not like copying my lecture material into the homework write-up, because if you review the lecture material, you don't intend to see that again, I assume. So, and I know I might get this wrong, this is the first time for some of the assignments in this class, so that might happen. And basically, the homework steps are you make this new system call, you really can just imitate what's done for an existing system call. And this is not like cheating. Like, if I was going to be adding something to Linux, I'm going to look at, hey, where's something similar that's already been done in Linux, and how does that work? And I'm just going to do the same stuff. Because I'm not someone who like wants to figure out all the details of how that part of Linux works. I'm just going to look at something existing that works. So you add it to several tables and lists, and you need this counter for the number of writes, which is just a global variable will do for this assignment. And then you create a user space program, and like with the system call, just look at an existing program, how it's set up in the makefile, copy that. You know, ideally you'd understand how things work, and I'd be glad to explain like, what is this line in the makefile doing? But many people probably did the assignment without actually understanding that, for better or worse. So, any questions on the homework? Yeah?
How is this going to be graded?
How is this going to be graded? If you're in this section, I intend to grade on functionality. And some sort of spot check, like, did you create a user space program that looks like it calls rate count? And as far as functionality, like, I will have my own programs that call write count, and they should work. Like, I should be able to compile them and make a, and boot the system with them by modifying things appropriately. Yes?
How are you checking for the newly added user space program that
tests write count? I haven't decided yet, but probably something stupid, like, grep the make file and look and see files or something like that. Yeah.
For the test file that we have, does that, like, the test file will go since a user program, right? Like, it's a user program?
Yeah, so the test file should be a user program. So it should be on the uprogs list in the make file.
So, like, the words that you said that you're going to test our write count, what if, like, aren't we just supposed to hard code and something just make sure that it works?
So your test program, we don't specify, so we're not going to check like how it works. Like, you can just, you can assume that you run something else to change the number of writes that have happened. You can have the test program do that itself. We just want you to have written a program that actually calls write count, because otherwise, how the hell would you know that write count actually is callable? Yeah, we don't want, the purpose there is just to make sure people don't say, yeah, that system call probably works, and say, done, hand it in, and then find out that there's actually no way of calling it, you know, they didn't add it to a table somewhere, so it doesn't do anything. That's the purpose of that. For our, we'll have our own test programs that, like, actually call write, and, like, make sure the counter makes sense. And if your program happens to do that too, no, then you're more likely to get full credit. Other questions? Okay. So last time I said we talked about context switches, and we talked about where information is saved. So our general rule is that we have a kernel stack where everything, all the state the operating system is giving for the process is saved. That's XV6's design choice. For all the, like, temporary state, like registers, user, and system, and, like, what exception handle we're running. And as we'll talk about today, there's some other state we need to keep around. Like, let's say we're not running from, and we want to run it again, we need to be able to find it. So there's information we need there, and there's information about, like, if you have a file open, where is that? We'll talk about where that information is today. So one note from a misunderstanding talking to office hours about stuff I showed you. So I showed you this code for setting up how the system calls work, that we set up with this funny macro, an entry in this table, the processor reads to say, hey, when you get this interrupt for system calls, I want you to go to my handler, which is this function in this list of, this function vector 64, which is in that table of functions. XV6 does this for every possible kind of exception. I didn't show you the code for that. You can find it around the same file. But for every possible kind of exception, it does something very similar to how the system call handler works. So if we have a seg fault, it's the same code path going up to this trap function. In that trap function, we're not going to call syscall because, well, a seg fault isn't a system call. Like, you don't want accessing invalid memory to invoke write count. But the path to enter the kernel and start the OS code is the same. And this is something where XV6 is, like, trying not to write the save all the registers code more than once. So they have exactly one copy of it that's used for absolutely everything. Okay. So any questions about that? Okay, so we're going to talk about a data structure used to represent a process. And we kind of have most of the information of a process that we've seen so far is in the kernel stack, but that's not really something where I can, like, look up a process, figure out what it's doing. And we're also missing some important things there, and we'll see a bunch of those. So we have a more organized way of giving information about the process, which generally is called a process control log. This is a term which is not an XV6 term. This is a generic term people use across all operating systems for wherever the struct or class that represents a process is called a process control log, which has all the information we need to know about the process. And in XV6, it's a struct called proc, P-R-O-C. And there's one of these for every running process, and here's the declaration for it. So it has a relatively modest number of fields. Like if you look at the equivalent structure on, say, Linux, which is called passstruct Linux, if you want to grep the Linux source code, it has like 10 times as many entries. But it's the same concept. And we have some important things here. So one thing we have here are our saved registers. So we have a pointer to a trap frame, and as we discussed, this points to the kernel stack. And we have a pointer to a context, which also points to the kernel stack. These are our saved registers. The trap frame is the saved user registers, the context is the saved kernel registers. And if our program is running, well, these pointers aren't valid, you shouldn't use them. If our program's like in user mode running, you shouldn't use these because we haven't saved the user registers, they're on the CPU, we don't have any kernel registers because we're not running, we haven't been running in kernel mode most recently. And similarly, if we're running in kernel mode, for this program, the trap frame is valid, but the context isn't because those are on the kernel stack, we haven't saved them yet. So we haven't switched away from the program we're currently running. But these are the places where we put them. So when we switch away from this program, we can go back to it. Or when we're in an exception handler and we want to say, set the return value of our system call, we can do that through the trap frame and say, change the registers that will be restored. We also have a pointer to the kernel stack itself. And this is the memory that when we created this program, we allocated to store that kernel stack. And we need a pointer to this in XV6, because when we get rid of the program, we want to deallocate that kernel stack. So we need to free it, and we can't free something we don't have a pointer to. We have some information about whether the process is running or not. So part of this is this enumeration called proc state, called of state, which has these possible values, unused. So that's for a struct proc that we've allocated, but don't have any, aren't using right now. Embryo, which is a name XV6 uses for one which is being set up, so it's not running yet, hasn't started running, but we're initializing it. Sleeping, which means it's not running and can't be run. So like, we called read, we're waiting for the user to press a key, those programs are in the sleeping state. We have runnable, so these are programs which, if you wanted to, you could start them right now on the CPU, but they aren't running on the CPU right now. So they aren't even waiting for anything like a key press, they have instructions to do right away. Then we have running, and these programs are actually on the CPU and actually running on some processor. XV6 supports multiple processors, so each of those processors can have one running process on them. And then we have this last zombie state. That's a program which has finished executing, but we still have a process structure for it. And we'll keep one around because we want to tell the program which ran that program, hey, the thing you ran finished, and here's how it finished, so we need to keep track of that information. And to keep things simple, the way we're going to do that is we're going to just keep the whole process struct around until we're done with it completely, until we've returned that information to the program which started it and said, hey, it's done, now you can take care of that. So to go along with this, we have two variables here. So one's called killed, and this is what we set when we want to get rid of the process. We want to terminate the process abnormally. And there's a bunch of places, including some we've seen on slides, incidentally, in the XV6 source code, where we check this flag and say, okay, whatever we're gonna do, let's just get rid of this process. So when we have an exception, we say, well, that was a system call, but the killed flag is set, so I'm just gonna exit. And this is how we make the kill command, which, you know, means sort of thing like control C, work in XV6. We also have this chan variable. So chan, I believe, stands for channel. And the idea is that if you're reading from something, this is what you're reading from. This is more general than that. This is just a variable representing, if I'm sleeping, why am I sleeping? What am I sleeping on? So if I'm reading from the keyboard, this will be a pointer to something representing the keyboard. If I'm waiting for another program to give me input, this will be a pointer to the way I'm communicating with the other program. If I'm waiting for a timer, this will be a pointer to the timer. And we use this to find out, for example, when the key press happens, we scan through all the processes in XV6 for the ones waiting on that thing. You might complain, wait, why would you scan through all the programs rather than just having a list of the ones which are waiting, say, on the keyboard? And the answer is, well, you probably should do that, but XV6 wanted to not have extra data structures. So they just did something slow that works and is easy to code. Yes?
Are the chans
event queues? So no, the chan is just a pointer to something. And we want to find out who's sleeping on something. We literally go through the entire process list, all the struct procs in the entire system, and check, is this chan equal to the keyboard? Is this chan equal to the keyboard? Is this chan equal to the keyboard? And when we find one, we say, okay, we're gonna wake up that process because I had a key press. So in a smarter OS, we would have a queue or a list or something like that rather than going through all the processes, because if I'm running like 100 processes, which is not uncommon on, say, my laptop, don't want to have to go through a list of 100 things every time I press a key. So we also have a process ID. So this is a way to identify this process in things like system calls. You could imagine, well, we could use just a pointer to this structure, but that's not something we expose to normal programs. We want to give them a convenient handle for things like kill. I want to kill this program to stop it from running. Well, we need to give it a way to say, what program do you want to kill? So we give it a process ID. So this is a unique ID for each program that's running, and we store it there. And in XV6, the way you look up a process by process ID is you scan the entire list of programs until you find the matching process ID. This is another thing where you might imagine a smarter OS would have like a hash table. But XV6 just wanted to write less code, so they just scan through the whole list. We also have some other information. So we have two variables here which represent the program's address space. So one of them is called pgdir, and this is a pointer to the actual page table. So hopefully you kind of vaguely remember that page tables are a thing which exists from a prior class. So this is a pointer to that page table. So this is the information the processor uses to know what the address space is. And this is what we tell the processor when we switch between programs to make it so we're running the appropriate program. We also have this variable SZ, which is the amount of space we have allocated. Basically, it's the size of the heap. And this is information XV6 needs to keep around in order to manage that memory, you know, that the processor doesn't ever use. Processor doesn't know this, this XV6 keeps around, so it knows when you resize the heap, what page table entries it needs to modify, and so on. We also have some information about open files. So we have, as we just briefly previewed earlier, files are the way we communicate with the terminal, including reading and writing to the screen. in addition to like files on disk. So we have an array of open files for each process, which are represented by this struct file. And we also have a representative of what the current directory for the process is, which is represented by a struct inode. Inode basically represents a directory or file on disk. And so that's almost all the fields. There's a few other fields that we will see incidentally later. So we have one called parent. We'll talk about what that means in a bit when we talk about how processes are created. And we have a name, which as this says, is for debugging. So XV6 remembers what program you executed, so it can, like, so like when it prints out a message, hey, your program crashed, it can print out the name of the program. So any questions about anything in this data structure? So do that. And you'll find something similar in pretty much every OS. And with the same kind of information, it just is likely to be more complicated because, for example, you might support more complicated memory allocations than XV6 does. You might have different ways of having open files. And you might have other kinds of system calls you support that XV6 just doesn't, that need information in each process. So XV6, we have to have a way to get at the processes. And as I mentioned, there's a global table. We don't actually search that global table to see which one is currently the running one. And there's two reasons for that. One is we have multiple CPUs, so we need to know which one's running on the current CPU. And the other reason is that that would be really, really slow, and we really, really often need to find the current process. We a lot less often need to find another process. So there's a function in XV6, which you can see used all over the code, called myproc, which retrieves the process that's currently running on whatever CPU we're running on. And here's an excerpt from the source code of that. So there's a global variable with a struct CPU, which has information for each processor. And in XV6, this is just size to n CPU, or n CPUs, the maximum number of CPUs that XV6 supports, maximum number of processors, maximum cores you can have. And this function just reads the number of this, reads the CPU using by reading from a special register on the processor to find out what's my CPU number. So there's some special OS-only register which tells us that. So it uses that to look up into that array. And then from the struct CPU, it retrieves a proc pointer, which is the currently running process. And we're just going to update this whenever we switch between programs. So part of the switching between processes that I didn't show you is updating this pointer so we can use this myproc function, which you see everywhere in the XV6 code. Okay. So that's managing the process control block. So we're going to be talking about not specifically XV6 for the next class and two, but about Unix in general. And XV6 imitates Unix, which is why one reason why we're looking at it. And we're using Unix because like we have source code to Unix OSs. They've been around for a while. You've probably used them before. But I need to talk about like what Unix is. And one reason for this is that we're going to show you like here's how you do something on Unix. And that's not as simple a statement as it might appear. Unix is a sprawling landscape of many, many different OSs. Each of these boxes represents a different OS. The lines represent how they're related, like how they shared source code. And yes, there are lines going horizontally. And like where two OSs were built by combining code from different OSs that have a common ancestor. So Unix is a mess. And a whole bunch of these, believe it or not, used to be commercial operating systems. So this is Linux. Here's OS X. We have FreeBSD, DragonflyBSD, NetBSD, OpenBSD. So those are all open source. They still exist. Most of the BSDs are not widely used. We also have like AIX, UnixWare, Solaris, HPUX, OpenSolaris. And a lot of these were commercially released Unixes, Unix operating systems, released by different vendors. So Sun Microsystems had one, IBM had AIX, still does in theory, though they probably would prefer to use Linux now. And HP had HPUX, and I don't remember who Open Server was, and UnixWare, but there were a whole bunch of these, and especially in the early 90s, Linux was very immature, and these were typically what people used. And since there were a whole bunch of these, there was a demand for a standard. We had all these Unix operating systems, which had lots of things in common, mostly because, well, they all shared code way back in the day, way back in the 70s. They all had common code that they all were forked from. And people wanted to like write code for, you know, their fancy web server application for Solaris and also have it work on AIX, because they wanted to sell to people who were buying from Sun Microsystems to get their expensive, you know, $1 million server, or from IBM to get their expensive $1 million server. And so they wanted a way where they could write for all these operating systems at once. So there was a standard, the Portable Operating System Interface, or POSIX. And no, I don't know where the X is. Which is a standard for Unix. And this standard has continued to have been updated into this decade, and still is developed a bit. And you can find the current version freely online, like full descriptions, including man page-like descriptions of every single function. And this is a standard, so this is something which is supposed to be followed by all these Unix-like OSs. So, like Linux tries to follow it, OS X mostly tries to follow it, and a whole bunch of other OSs. And historically in the 90s, when this was really important, we had like four or five widely used OSs which all tried to follow this standard. And the idea is that you can write code to this standard and have it work in all of those OSs, even though they have different implementations of lots of things. But OSs do add extra features, and POSIX, because it's designed for writing applications, it doesn't specify anything under the hood. In particular, POSIX specifies a library and shell interface. So it specifies some minimal things the shell needs to do, and library functions that need to exist. Stuff you need for source code compatibility. The idea is that if you have your web server written for Solaris, if you follow POSIX, you can take that same source code, recompile it on AIX, and sell to an AIX customer. But POSIX, for example, doesn't care what is or isn't a system call. It just has library calls. Some of them it strongly suggests are probably system calls, but it doesn't actually specify how they're implemented. It doesn't specify binary formats. It's source code compatibility. It doesn't say, I can take an executable from one OS and put it on another. Okay. So we're going to talk about things that are in this POSIX library interface. In particular, we're going to talk about how you create processes in that interface. So before I move on to that, any questions about what POSIX is and why we're using it? Okay, so POSIX has a whole bunch of functions around managing processes. So probably the simplest one is getPID. So we saw a process ID field, because sometimes we have system calls or library calls in the POSIX case where we need to use a process ID. We went away to get our own process ID, and the function for that is getPID. So it returns a PIDT, which is some kind of integer, Because POSIX is trying to be portable, it doesn't tell you if it's a long or an int or a short, but it's some kind of integer. And it tells your current process's ID. And this is the same ID you can see, for example, if you type PS, you have a table with PIDs, one for my shell, one for the program PS itself. And these are things that we'll see used in one other place today where we need to specify what program am I talking about to the library. So then we have probably the most confusing thing on this list, which is fork. Fork is the way POSIX specifies for creating processes. And fork doesn't take any arguments, and it returns a PID. And the way it works is it copies the current process. So it makes a copy of the current process, and it returns twice. Once in the original process, it returns the ID of the copy. And then again, in the copy, it returns zero. And since it's a copy, everything except for the process ID and the return value is duplicated. It's duplicated between the parent and child, including the contents of memory. And yes, that seems really slow. We'll talk about why it's not much later in the semester. All the file descriptors, which is going to be, we'll talk about probably next time, which is open files. And all the values of registers. Yes? So the question is, when it returns zero in the child, is that a process ID? The answer is no. So this is, not a PID of a real program. There is a way to get the process ID of the parent. The simplest way is you call getPID before you call fork. The less simple way is, the about as simple but you didn't know it way is that there's a library call called getPPID for get parent process ID, which we'll see later. Yes?
So is this creating a new process? Like, will the parent process still be there?
Yes. So then, and I have a picture to hopefully illustrate that.
So with the, if you modify the registers in the child function, does that mean it's going to modify the registers in the parent?
So the question is, if you modify them in the child, it's not affecting the parent. Hopefully this will be clearer when I show this. So what fork does is we have our parent process control block. It includes all the saved user registers. It includes a pointer to the kernel stack. It includes a pointer to the user memory. It has a list of open files and a whole bunch of other information. And what we do in fork is we copy it. But it's not a shallow copy, it's a deep copy. So we also allocate new space for the kernel stack in the user memory. So we copy those, and then we change the return value, so we return differently. So we, in fact, have different values for the registers when we return from fork in the parent and the child. In the parent, we give you the new PID, in the child, we give you zero. Yeah?
What's like a use case of this?
What?
What's like a use case? Like, when is this used?
Why would you use fork? So that's your question. So the primary reason you're going to use fork is because for the most part, this is the only way to create new processes. There is no other option. This is not entirely true, but it's basically true. This is the only thing that existed in POSIX for a long time, and it's the only thing that's widely supported in POSIX for creating new processes. So you might say, but I don't want a copy of my program. We'll fix that later. Because typically, yeah, you don't. But this is your only option. You have to start with a copy of your program. And then you, later on, you can make it be actually what you want it to be. And we'll see a different system call, a different library call for doing that later. Yes?
So it's for the whole like setup from last class where pretend as if the class already exists, or is that something different?
So the right question is fork does the whole setup for
like how we want to create a new process with using a context switch?
So the implementation of fork in XV6 does the setup we saw, yes, before, where we create a dummy kernel stack that's about to return from something, it turns out. This is not the only way you could implement it, which is why like you could maybe actually copy the kernel stack if you had things in a certain way. But in XV6, the way it's implemented is it actually constructs that new kernel stack we saw for a new process. But just with a process control block, that's a copy of an old one. But the kernel stack is new, and in XV6, it's just set up in the way we saw. Other questions? Yes?
So if you have allocated memory in your parent process, do you have to free it in both the parent and the child?
So the question is, if you've allocated memory in your parent process, do you have to free it in both the parent and the child? Yes. If you free, because it's now a copy, if you free in the parent, it doesn't do anything in the child, and vice versa. So the memory, once we do the fork, is independent. So other questions about this picture? So here's what fork looks like in a call. So we have this program, I call get PID, I print out my PID, then I call fork. And if I get a PID greater than 0, that means I'm in the parent and fork is telling me what's the ID of the program I just spawned. So here I print out, okay, my PID is this, I call get PID again, which will return the same thing as it returned originally. And I'm the parent of, and this new child PID. And child PID is 0, then I'm in the child process. And I can get my PID by calling get PID, that's why it doesn't return it for me, because I already can figure it out that way. And I print that out. So, yeah. So, and so the output might look like this. You know, just making up some process IDs. So questions about this output? Okay. So some other notes about this code. So I have a bunch of casts to int, and that's because I'm using printf with %d, and I don't know whether PID is an int or long or short or something else, so I just cast to make sure it doesn't fail. If you were using cout, you wouldn't have to worry about this problem. I have this case here where I call this function pierre. So fork can fail. The most obvious case is if I'm out of memory. Fork wants to make a copy of all my memory, it runs out of memory, it's gonna fail. And when it fails, it returns -1 cast to a PID, which is not greater than 0 or equal to 0. And so I'll hit this code, and this pierre function reads an error number, which is stored in this special global variable, erno, and prints out the error message corresponding to it with prefixed by fork failed colon. And an example error message that you get if you were out of memory would be resource temporarily unavailable. On Linux, that is. Other OSs might do something different. Yes?
So if any process hasn't used fork, so it hasn't been copied,
does that mean the child PID is 0? So the question is, if a process hasn't used fork, does that mean the child PID is 0? So fork always makes a new child. And this is true even if you already have a child process. So I can call fork multiple times, and each time I will make a new copy of my process control log. Also, if I am a copy of another program, I can call fork again, and I don't make a copy of the original, I make a copy of the copy. And in that copy, and you know, and the, there will be a copy of a copy, and I'll get the PID of that copy of a copy normally. So it always, in one process, is going to return the new PID, and in the new process, going to return zero. But we can have like a big hierarchy of copies. In fact, we will, because if you think of like, I run my shell, I run it, open a new window for a shell in my shell, and I run a program in that, like that's two layers deep, that's pretty common. Yes?
They're independent memory-wise, but if the parent process ends, the child process ends as well.
The question is, if the parent process exits, does the child exit? No. They continue executing independently. You might have a problem of, you might have noticed there's a pointer to the parent. You might wonder what happens to that. We'll explain later. We're talking about waiting for programs. Yes? So fork returns the child ID to the parent and zero to the child. It never returns the parent's ID. The way I think about this is fork always gives me enough information to find the ID of the child. If I'm in the child process, I just call get PID instead of using fork's return value. If I'm in the parent process, get PID won't tell me anything about the new process, so I need fork's return value. Yes?
If you have multiple child processes, will it only return the most recent one?
Yes, if you have multiple child processes, will it only return the most recent? Yes. Turns the one it created because you called for. So, now that we know about fork, here's some code that uses fork. So suppose the PID of the parent process is 99 and the child is 100. What are two possible outputs of this? And you might say, why are there two possible outputs? Well, it's because there are two programs which are running in parallel, and I haven't given you any reason to believe that when we have a choice between running the parent and child process, the original and the copy, that we run the copy first or the original first. So either of those could happen. So I'll give you a few minutes or so. Think about this, check with your neighbor. Note that there is one thing that is perhaps not obvious.
For the shell, do you have to account for operators inside of strings? Yeah.
Thank you.
someone want to volunteer an answer? Yeah. Okay, so it's gonna print out, so your output is child 100, then, and that's it, and done. Is that it? So remember, fork returns twice. So you've done correctly half of this, the fork returning the first time in the child, or sorry, in the parent, but it also returns in the child. So what's that going to do? Yes, so that will print in child and done. Note that done happens in the both the parent and the child, because there's nothing stopping it from doing that. Yes?
So when it's in the parent function, fork doesn't overwrite the parent process of PID, right? It just overwrites the return value.
Yes, so fork doesn't change anything about the parent process.
So if you ran get PID on the parent process,
yes, it would be. And we saw this in the previous example where here we have 100 output here, which is the same as was output before. Okay, so how about another possible output? Yeah. What just switched around? Yeah, so we could also have had the child run first. Apologies for my handwriting, and then child 100 done. And that is not, and there are more than two possible outputs, so you could also have them interleaved. Just depending on when things get run, when timers expire. Okay. Questions about any of this? Yeah.
Why does it print like the if and the else?
So why does it print the if and the else? So this part is printed in the copy, which is the child. And this part is printed in the original, which is the parent. And both the copy and the original are still processes that get to run. So they both get to do all their output.
I think
of
a switch.
Oh, that is quite possible, especially because I put in child conveniently in the output of the child. So this is the, yeah, this is the copy, and this is the original. I should figure out my pen lock. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So both the original and the copy output have to happen. They don't necessarily have to happen in any particular order, and they can in fact, like here, be interleaved. Like, yeah, sorry. Like down here, be interleaved. Yeah. Why doesn't the child fork again? Because when the child starts executing, it's executing in the assignment to PID. So it's already done the call to fork. So there's no reason to call fork again. The child, if there was another call to fork, then yes, both the parent and child would make a copy of each other and we'd have four processes in total. But there's only one call to fork. And when the child starts executing, that call to fork is done. First thing it executes is returning from that call to fork. Yes?
If you wrote a program that just calls fork over and over, will it kind of split on your computer?
So the question is, if I just call fork in a loop, what happens? Well, probably you run out of resources. And if your OS is good at dealing with this, you just run out of resources. If your OS is bad at dealing with this, then yeah, your computer goes really slow. It can't deal with running, you know, 10,000 processes. So that's fork. So we talked about creating processes, and I have a separate entry here for running programs. So that's going to be a different step with a different function. So we have exec. There's a whole bunch of library calls which start with exec. The one I'm going to show here is execv, but there's a few others. They're all very similar. They just take a program to run and arguments to supply the program. And what exec does is it replaces the current program, the current process, with a new program. So exec does not return. Instead, it takes your process control block and changes all its data to be for the new program. And typically, you'll use exec with fork. You'll want to make a new process, and instead of having that new process run the same program, you want it to run a different program. So here's an example of that pattern. So we have fork here, we call fork, and if we're in the child process, we call execv, and here I'm saying I want to run the program /bin/ls. That's the name of the executable file I want to run. And the arguments I'm supplying are ls minus l, and I have a null to indicate that's the end of the arguments. So this will start ls with argv containing ls and minus l, and argc set to 2. And it replaces the current program. And that means that if everything goes well, execv doesn't return. Instead of returning, our process is replaced with ls, our child processes. So if execv returns, that means something went wrong. Like, for example, maybe binls doesn't exist. And in that case here, I have code which prints an error message and exits. I exit because otherwise this child process on an error would end up running code down here. Probably don't want that. And I want to print an error, which is probably going to be something like no such file or directory if like binls doesn't exist. Okay. So questions about this piece of code? Yeah.
Are you saying that there's no like context switch that occurs, like it just overrides the current process?
Yeah, so the question is, am I saying there's no context switch, it just overrides the current process? Yes. And I have a picture for that, which I will show on the next slide. So here we have our process control block. Oh, sorry, I have an error on this, but that will be clear. And when exec happens, we just allocate a new stack and heap and load from the executable file for the new program. And we also copy the arguments over to the new stack. Typically, that's where they're stored from our old process. You know, don't change anything else and get rid of the old memory. So that's what execs do. So it's just changing the memory to the new program's memory, including loading it, making a copy of the arguments, and putting it in the new process, along with its initial loaded memory. And then it returns, and it set our user registers to the initial values, like the initial place we start the new program, the initial value of like EAX, ESP, the stack pointer, and so on. So we just return from the interrupt into the system call into the new program. Yes? Yes, so notice that we only changed the fields of the process control block we needed to. And the PID is one of them, we didn't change it. How does it know which process it's on if the PID doesn't change? If we went to know, we have the process control block for the current process, that's the one we're changing. So our PID is stored in there, that's our old PID and our new PID, it doesn't change. So we also didn't even change the open files. Like, didn't have a reason to change it, so that's not changed, stays the same. So that means that if it's outputting to the terminal now, the new program we're running also outputting to the terminal. So questions on this? Yeah.
Is the reason you have the 42 and 33 crossed out, or is that just saying that it's not changing at all?
So that's the reason I have the 42 and 133 crossed out. Yes, because that's so whatever values we had for registers in the old program, that's one of the things exec is going to change. Because when we start a new program, we generally start it where all the registers have known values. So as part of loading the program, we're going to like set the initial stack pointer, set the initial program counter. So we're going to overwrite all the user registers. So other questions about this? Okay. And I guess a note I will give about exec. The first argument to exec is a file name of a process. Note that that is independent from argv of 0, the first argument, which in this case is ls. Typically they match, but there's no actual requirement for that. Like, it's just like, you probably should do that so you don't get confused. Yeah. So the question is here, what happens to the kernel stack? In this picture, the kernel stack doesn't get deallocated. We just keep it. I believe this is what XP6 does, I'm not actually sure. So as I mentioned earlier, POSIX, like, it imagines a particular implementation, like it's designed to run Unix, but it doesn't specify what has to happen, so you could do either. Yeah?
Does it have to be executable file?
So the question is, does the path to an executable file to exec take into account environment variables? So you're saying, I know that my shell, it looks at some setting called path, figure out where things are running. Does exec take this into account? No. If you're calling exec and you want to like search for programs in particular directories, with this version of exec, you need to do that. There's some other variants where you don't. This version, that's your job. You better know where the executable actually is. It's not going to be found for you. Yeah?
So one reason like exec would fail, if ls fails, it won't make exec fail.
So the question is, if ls fails, it won't make exec fail. That is correct. Exec is, did we successfully load the new program? So it might fail if ls doesn't exist, or if we run out of memory when we try to load the new program. But it's not going to fail if ls starts running and then crashes. Like then, yeah, we started ls fine. That was great. Just something afterwards happened that was bad. Okay. So talking about environment variables. So environment variables are part of the process state that you see in POSIX. I'm going to talk about them briefly. I'm talking about them here. You'll see why on the next slide. So every process has a whole bunch of environment variables associated with it, which are just key value pairs. But if you've had to do certain things in the shell, you would have seen these because these are the way you do certain things in the shell. Printenv is a command which just prints all the current environment variables. You can see that when I ran this, I had a whole lot. And POSIX has some functions to get and set them. And like everything else, these are inherited when you spawn a new program by default. The default is that if I have an environment variable set, if I call puttingNV with key equals value later on, even after I exec ls, ls can get env and read that key. There is a variant of exec you will see, which had, so one of them is execve, which takes this pointer envp. And that's if you want to specify a new environment variable, new set of environment variables, rather than inheriting all the old ones. And the way that works is similar to the arguments, but you have strings of key equal value. And typically, but not required, the way execv works is it calls execve, but with the current environment variables. I'm like, really, this is what gets run. So this is not terribly important, but I know you're likely to come across environment variables if you use and Unix like OS, so I'd like to tell you a little bit about like how they work, the API for them, and that they're part of exec, because when you look up exec, which you only might do for the shell assignment that's coming up, you might see this, and I'd like you to know what the heck is going on. Okay, questions? Okay, and as was hinted, like there's a bunch of common things you see environment variables used for. One of them is, where do I find programs? There's just a convention that we expect the path environment variable to be used for that. And you might see them used for like, where's my home directory? That's stored in an environment variable, so programs can look it up, and so on. So I'd like to get to like the nagging question is, okay, so I showed you this fork exec pattern, and this is how in POSIX and Unix we make we spawn a new program like you would probably thought. And you'd say, why isn't this just a single library call? Why do we split it up into these two parts? Isn't fork really hard to implement? And we could just have a function which spawns a new program as a new process. And in fact, some other OSs do this. So Windows, for example, has a library call called createProcess, which is the canonical way to create a new process, and that new process isn't a copy of a current process. You just specify, make a new process which is running this executable. The awkwardness with that, and probably the big reason why Unix made the choice it did, is that you need to have an API to set all the new state. You want to change where the current directory for that new process is, well, you need a way of specifying that. You want to have different file. You want to have it like open to a different file. As far as where its output goes, you need to have a way of specifying that, and so on. You want to set environment variables, you need to have a way of specifying that, and so this spawning a new process call actually gets a little complicated. But it's a reasonable choice, and Windows makes it. And POSIX, in fact, has an option for doing this called POSIX spawn. So that's a library call which forks and execs, basically, in one call. And conceptually, could be implemented with something simpler than forking, as far as like not making a copy of our program's memory and then discarding that copy to spawn a new program. But it probably isn't. And generally, though I'm mentioning it, it's often not implemented. Like, I don't think OSX has it at all, for example. Or it's implemented very poorly because it's not a high priority. Because everyone uses fork because that's what's supported. Okay, questions about this? Okay, so talked about creating a new process and making that new process run a different program, a program like ls that we might want to run. Now let's talk about waiting for a process to finish, and we're going to talk mainly about a function called waitPID, which is wait for a process using its PID. So this is the prototype for waitPID. We take a process ID to wait for, which typically would have been a process ID we got from fork earlier. And it takes a pointer to a variable called status, and that's where it's going to store status information, which is like, how did this program exit? And also it has an options variable. You can look at the manual page in this class, or at least for my examples, I'll just use 0 for no options. We don't have any we care about. So there is a special value of PID. You can supply a PID of -1, which will just wait for any process, which is why it returns a PID. So if you supply -1, it just, whatever one finishes first, it returns that PID and handles that. Or you can wait for a specific child process of all the ones you forked, in which case you specify the PID you want to wait for. So let's talk about this status variable a bit. So this is very related to exit statuses. When you have main, you return 0 or something else, or you exit passing a 0 or something else, that's a process's exit status. And the status variable encodes that information, and so that's what we're retrieving with waitPID. In addition to knowing that the process finished, we also get to find out what its exit status was, Or, as we'll see later, we get to find out maybe it didn't terminate by exiting, maybe we control seed it. And we get to find that out. And our typical pattern is that when we fork, we're going to wait for the child in the parent if we just want to run a program to completion. This is like a common pattern you'll see when I just want to run a program, wait for it to finish, be done. So then we get the status variable, and I haven't shown you how to interpret that. And you might assume, well, hey, it's an int. Main returns an int. So probably it's just what main returns. And unfortunately, no, it is not. It's a little more complicated than that. So it encodes both the return value and if the exit was abnormal, and if it was abnormal, like what caused it. So there are these macros declared in the syswait header, which start with a W, which let you decode that. So after I call this, assuming it succeeds, if it exited, this test, did it terminate by exiting? Like, did main return, or did we call exit? Like, did it terminate normally? And if so, I can get what was the return value from main from that int with this W exit status macro. I can also see if it was signaled, and we'll talk about signals on the next slide, and I can figure out what signal caused it to terminate. And there are macros for the signals, which all start with sig, and returns one of the numbers, which is one of those special values that's in a header file. So questions on the exit status part of this? Okay. So signals broadly are a way of communicating between processes. We're going to mostly ignore that part of signals. And the part we're going to care about right now is that they're also how abnormal termination happens. You send a signal to a process, which, well, when you want to send something, you might think you use something like called send. In fact, you use something called kill to send something to a process. And wait status tells you what signal killed the program, and there's signals for all the ways you can think of programs crashing or otherwise not exiting normally. So for example, and these are all constants in signal.h, so these are integer values that correspond to each of these reasons. So sigint means control C. So if control C happens, when we call the status, we'll have W if signaled will be true for the status, and W term sig will be equal to the value sigint. We also have sigterm, which is what the kill command, if you've ever used that from the command line, does by default. We have sigsegv, which is the signal that causes the segmentation fault message that you've seen in your shell probably, maybe once or twice. Sigbus, which causes the bus error signal that those of you on OS X may have seen in your terminal once or twice. And sigabort is if you call the abort function, that's what signal it causes, and so on. And there's a whole bunch of these. This is how we indicate abnormal termination. Yes? Sigkill is one of the is another signal, which is not the default thing the kill command does. Even though you might think it should be. Okay. That's abnormal termination, but it also gives us normal termination. We can also, for example, I mentioned that wait PID takes a PID of -1 to indicate wait for everything, so you can use this to wait for all the children. Because if wait PID fails, it returns -1. This is a pattern we're going to see through all the POSIX calls, is that when they fail, they return -1 and set error node to a value. So this here, I'm just explicitly testing for, hey, did wait PID fail? Did it return -1? And if so, is the error e-child? If I look up in the manual page, it turns out e-child is the error for, hey, you asked me to wait, but there was nothing to wait for. So this is the code you'd write if you didn't bother to keep track of what were all the things I forked. Also, the code you'd write if you wanted to wait for the processes you spawn with fork to finish, you know, and see what them finish in order. They like take very different amounts of time to finish. Yes?
A child of my child is not my child, right?
The question is, a child of your child is not your child. Yes, grandchildren do not count for wait PID. You can only wait PID for a child, a process you forked. Even if you know the PID of another process on the system, if you call wait PID with it, it will return an error saying, sorry, that's not your child. You can't wait for it, that's someone else's job. So, since we're talking about waiting for child processes, that's ones you forked, every process has a parent process. And this is the process that can wait for it. And there's a process ID 1, which doesn't have a parent. This is the first process that ran on the system. And this creates a tree of processes, starting with process ID 1, which you can see in very small print here. And this is a command called ps-tree, which I use to print out that tree of processes on my desktop. And that's not a complete, my desktop's running a lot of processes. So it has this big tree, family tree of processes, but you can only wait for direct children. So you might have some questions if I said each process has a parent process. So what if the parent process exits before the child? I told you earlier that, you know, they run independently. They can exit in either order. So what happens? The child's parent process becomes process ID 1. So it gets reparented to process ID 1 just because we need to have it have a parent. And one of the things process ID 1 will do is we'll wait for all its child processes just to make sure they get cleaned up. And possibly to log information about it, if you care. And if you never wait, or wait PID for a process, remember earlier on I told you about process states and there's one called zombie? Well, it's just gonna stay in that state because maybe we'll call wait. And it needs to remember, oh, there was a process with this ID which finished and it had this exit status. It needs to know that exit status. The OS needs to keep that around, so it's going to reserve that process ID until we wait for it, because we don't want to get confused and have two processes with the same ID, even if one of them's finished and one of them's not. And if a non-parent tries to wait PID for, you know, our child process, what's going to happen? That non-parent process, that other process, you're going to error. Wait PID is going to say, nope, sorry, only the parent can do that. Okay, so, and in summary, this is our typical pattern, and typically what you'll be doing with all the things we saw today, fork, exec, wait PID. Questions on this? And you can also do this with multiple processes, so you might do something like this, where you fork a child process, you exec in the child, and the parent, you just keep track of the PID, so you fork a whole bunch of processes, and later on, you wait for all of them. That's a very common pattern. Or alternately, you could do this in some order. And, you know, with the -1, with the wait for any process version, if you wanted to handle them in the order they finish instead of in whatever order you put them in that vector. So I guess as a brief preview, one of the reasons we're discussing this is that the next assignment is going to be to implement a shell, which is the thing that you use to run programs. Typically, this is the command line thing, and that's the POSIX version of a shell, and that's what we're gonna have you do. And that's the big reason we're discussing all these. So next time, we're gonna talk about the APIs for files. And you remember that your shell supports things like sending the output of a command to a file, so we'll talk about how you do that sort of thing next time.